Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Smell Podcast. I'm your host, Katie Boateng. This week, join me in listening to an episode with Dr. Stella Lee, MD, and John Moore, a clinical research coordinator, both with the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. We discuss their work on the nose or neuromapping olfactory stimulation via encephalography project, and their smell loss and neurological function during and after COVID-19 infection study, along with many other topics. Our interview was recorded in November 2020. Let's listen to the interview.
Hello, everyone, and thank you so much for joining me for the Smell Podcast. Today, I actually have two people who are here with me, so I'll ask them both to do introductions. So to start off, John, can you please tell us a little bit about yourself? Where are you from and where do you live now?
Sure. So my name is John Moore. I'm actually from Erie, Pennsylvania, and I've been living in Pittsburgh for, almost 6 years now. So it went pretty fast. And I am what's called a clinical research coordinator at the University of Pittsburgh, and I've been doing that for about 5 years. And I work very closely with Dr. Stella Lee, and we've been working on sinonasal disease research and olfactory research since, I've been here. We started with drug trials and then moved into some more internal olfactory research, I'd say the past 3 years or so.
Excellent. Thank you. And then on to you, Dr. Lee. Can you please tell us a little bit about yourself? Where are you from and where are you currently?
Yes. Hi, everyone. I'm from Los Angeles, California, and I've been living in Pittsburgh for about 11 years now. And my primary research is in rhinology. I'm an otolaryngologist, which is a long way of saying basically an ear, nose, and throat physician. But specifically, I'm a nose doctor. So I am very interested in the nose and the sinuses. And as John mentioned, a lot of research related to how we smell, how we can perhaps regain smell with disease, patients with chronic sinus disease, and we can talk further about our research.
Yeah, definitely. So kind of for both of you, I'm always interested to figure out how did you get involved in the world of smell? So John, let's start with you. What is a little bit about your educational background and basically why smell and how did you end up where you are right now?
Sure. I kind of made my way to sinus research and smell research kind of in a wayward path. My background is actually in psychology, and I have a lot of research experience as an undergrad and with schizophrenic patients and other psychosis disorders. And I was doing that for about 2 years and then transitioned just looking for more of a, career stability. And I had a lot of research experience. So then I ended up at the university, like I said, working initially on clinical drug trials for treatment-resistant sinus disorders. So it was all very new for me, coming from a background in like schizophrenia research. So I've learned about nose and sense of smell just, on the job. And it's actually been very interesting and rewarding. I know a lot more about the nose now than I ever expected to. So that's kind of how I ended up here.
That's interesting. Yeah, I feel like a lot of us who are impacted with anosmia ourselves, we end up learning quite a bit more about smell and the nose than we thought that we ever would. Sure. So on to you then, Dr. Lee, kind of what is your educational background? How did you end up being an otolaryngologist? Sure. Why smell? And basically, how did you get involved?
So otolaryngology is a wonderful field because we can help patients hopefully recover and I think smell, it's often referred to as the Cinderella of the senses because it's often not paid attention to like some of the other senses, but it's so important to how we taste our food, flavor, memories, just experiencing the world in general. So it significantly impacts quality of life. And that's why I decided to do a rhinology fellowship. I did my otolaryngology training at Yale and then I went on to Johns Hopkins to do a fellowship in rhinology and skull-based surgery. So since then, I've been focusing on smell and the significant inflammation that may cause loss of smell, specifically chronic sinus disease, but also now, as we know, with COVID-19.
Yeah, definitely. It's been an unfortunate side effect of that virus, but a lot of people have actually started to learn what the words anosmia and parosmia and things like that mean. So it's been an unfortunate, but I think it's been positive in one way, just for the fact that it is raising awareness about the fact that, those things can happen. Okay, so moving on to another question for you both. You are both currently involved in two ongoing olfactory projects, which is why I wanted to speak with you all for the podcast. So can you tell us a little bit more about both of those projects? What are they called? And basically, what are the goals of those? And I don't know, John or Dr. Lee, if you wanted to take that first.
Yeah, John, go ahead. You can start, sure. And I can also add as well.
Sure. So I think our first, definitely not Dr. Lee's first, but my first olfactory study that I got involved in and very passionate about is what we creatively named the NOSE Initiative. So NOSE stands for Neuromapping Olfactory Stimulation via Encephalography. And really, we got into this study because you're probably familiar with it. You know, Katie, you've probably heard of the UPSIT, the University of Pennsylvania Smell Identification Test. And sniffing sticks, and we face this challenge where the clinical ways we measure smell are very subjective, and you know they rely on being able to identify smell and word recognition, and a lot of people lose their sense of smell due to neurodegenerative disorders like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, and so it's not the greatest way to measure olfaction.
Right.
And so Dr. Lee and I, well, she wanted to get an olfactometer, and we wanted to try and visualize smell and really see what a healthy sense of smell looks like and compare it to a non-functioning sense of smell in the brain. And so we built our own olfactometer because the commercial ones are very pricey. And we met a great group here at the University of Pittsburgh who designed their own to work with mice. They helped us scale it up to humans. And we have been using it because it works well in a non-magnetic environment. And so we have been piloting it with basically ourselves, who are healthy, non-smoking adults whose sense of smell luckily functions. And we've been doing what's called magnetoencephalography. So MEG for short. And it's basically a helmet you sit in that measures your brain function through very sensitive magnetometers, devices that measure magnetic fields. And when our brain's natural electric current leaves residual magnetic fields after we think or visualize things or smell or basically anything our body does, our brain will use electricity to communicate with neurons. And this MEG is very sensitive and can map our brain function in millisecond timing. And why we like it so much is when you go into the MEG beforehand, you make a 3D digital map of your head, and you can use an MRI to localize your brain function data to an image of your brain. And so it's a good way to learn where smell is happening in the brain and what's going on when your smell is induced and how your brain reacts to different odors. And so that is probably our primary olfactory study. And then secondly, when we found out that COVID-19 was causing this wave of anosmia around the world, wanted to learn more about it and understand if it's, you know, causing cognitive deficits at all, if there's relation between smell loss and deficits in neurologic functions. So we started recruiting patients who are actively sick with COVID-19, who have recovered from COVID-19, and then healthy controls who tested negative for COVID-19 and are no longer symptomatic. So we've recruited about 105 people so far since April when we started the study. And so that's kind of our two primary olfactory studies summarized right now.
So that's fantastic. And just a quick question that comes up for me in this regard is I'm imagining myself, let's say someone who has a functioning sense of smell sitting within this helmet, and then you providing them, I'm imagining with like things to smell. How do you know that's what is being triggered? Like, how do you know that the scent itself is why their brain is lighting up?
Gotcha. So it's takes very talented people who are very good at math and physics. So we tested the device on myself. And what we do is we can deliver odors with these, what's called solenoid valves, and they're triggered by electrical impulses in millisecond timing. So say I would smell the odor of rose for 50 milliseconds. When the smell is released is time locked with the computer that's collecting the data. And then what we would do is collect resting data before you're smelling, and they would look for signaling that's coming from you breathing in and out, or your eyes moving, or your heart beating. And someone who's very good at statistics can capture this background data and then subtract it out and look at the very specific changes that occur when olfaction is actually going on. And like I said, it's really sensitive. So for me, for example, you could see a 40% increase in my alpha waves in my brain, in my magnetic output, within 40 milliseconds, so less than half a second of when smell was released. So it takes statisticians and physicists, but these people are great at identifying what we would call noise compared to the actual stimulus you're trying to capture.
That's and we actually understand the chemical structures of things like a rose, you know, phenylethyl alcohol. And we also know the chemical structures of something like banana, which seems really complex. And also really interesting is that these scents do trigger certain emotions in different parts of the brain, as well as memory. So it's very complex in the human, and we don't really understand it. And so hopefully this research will shed some light on that.
Yeah, and another thing that I'm just thinking of as you guys are speaking about this is you mentioned before in regards to like the upset and the sniff and sticks, those are like forced choice testing on people who have smell disorders. So for myself, like I've taken the upset, I scored very low on it, but from what I did score, I just assumed that it was guessing because I identify myself as completely anosmic. So I would be fascinated to know a little bit more about how this nose testing works on people who have anosmia, because maybe my brain is perceiving something that I'm not. Do you guys, have you had people who have anosmia inside the machine yet?
So that would be our next step. So we are, the kind of a catch-22 is because we designed the device ourselves, we're piloting on ourselves as healthy test subjects. And then once our data is complete, we'll go back to our institutional review board, so our IRB at the University of Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. And that would be the process to approve our machine for use in anosmic patients. So we're hoping in early next year, because we're actually doing pilot data pretty much weekly now, to start working with anosmic patients with chronic rhinosinusitis. Hopefully people would be interested to come in who have lost their smell from brain injury or infectious disease. But that, I guess, is the next step of our nose initiative.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, though, because just like, you know, an audiogram, which is a hearing test, checks for sensory neural, which is the nerve part of the sense, versus conductive, which means that there's something blocking the ability to for a sound or odorant to reach that particular nerve. Hopefully, that's our goal, is to develop something that's objective that can tell us, is this a neural issue? Is it at what level is it? Is it at the very periphery? We need to map the human olfactory neurons and see if there really is high fidelity, a significant pattern that emerges. We still don't really understand that. And also, if there's other patterns, like a conductive loss, which means that maybe the odorants aren't able to get to the neurons. And then even a more higher level, that is more on a cognitive level. So it's very interesting you ask that, because brings to mind several patients who remember what the smell, what a particular scent smelled like. Mm-hmm. And they did score better on the upset, even though it wasn't expected. So perhaps there is a cognitive component that can be important. And that's where smell training, I think, can help too, because right. You're also imagining what that smell, what it was like to smell that scent in particular.
Yeah, this is all very exciting. I feel like if you can get this up and running with a larger scale of people, that this is going to be really groundbreaking, because you are correct that currently the smell tests that are out there are very subjective. What I interpret as a certain smell is not necessarily what you would.
Yeah, absolutely. And even there's ethnic differences, and our smell is, there's so many nuances to it, right, that are impacted by our previous experiences. So completely agreed that I like to use the word paradigm shifting, because as of now, we haven't really thought of smell that way. And we use a lot of subjective, human dependent kind of tests. But if there really was a truly objective way, you know how like babies, when they're born, they get an auditory brainstem reflex test. It's just like that little probe that tests if their nerve is working. Wouldn't it be great if we could also have kind of a nice feedback of how the human olfactory nerve is working and where maybe the deficits are occurring? So then we can target those areas to help fix the problem.
Yeah, definitely. And you saying something about a paradigm shift actually reminds me of a previous podcast guest that we've had on. I don't know if you're familiar with Dr. Ann Sophie Barwich and her book, Smellosophy, but she's advocating for looking at the world through the sense of smell versus like the sense of sight.
Oh, wow. I need to read that book. I have not read the book, but it sounds like a great read.
Sounds really interesting.
Very relevant.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So you will probably want to check that one out. So yeah, I guess you had this nose project going up. So the neuromapping, olfactory stimulation via encephalography. Hopefully I said that right.
Yeah.
And then kind of, I guess, COVID just sort of fell into your guys' laps at this time. And it was probably relatively easy to start that study, right? So with that in mind, I guess, how are you recruiting people to participate in your studies? How are you reaching out to them?
So, you know what? It actually was not as easy as you would expect. So when we first started this, we had no idea how to reach patients. I mean, because we're not in critical care medicine or infectious disease. So, you know, when this started, everything was very new for us, like everyone else. I was sent to work from home. I think Dr. Lee was doing telemedicine visits at the time, and we didn't have our lab and contacts and the usual network of people we could work with to help with research recruitment. It was very hard to even recruit within our medical center because, of course, there's a barrage of treatment studies that were going on with COVID patients. And so it really picked up pace with the help of Chrissy from Absent, where she allowed us to advertise our study online, and we started to recruit people from the UK and people from all over the United States. And then Dr. Lee really helped with recruitment. She would refer people to me that she was, you know, seeing around the United States who have lost their smell, who wanted to get an appointment with her, and they're interested in being in our study. And then they were sharing, we met people, you know, firefighters from New York City and, you know, first responders and the larger cities that were being impacted, Los Angeles, and their friends were being affected by COVID and smell loss. So they started to share our study as well. And then I think we really took off in recruitment, where the University of Pittsburgh has a great system called All of Us. It's a research program, or Pitt Plus Me research program, where people could register to be contacted for research. And they allowed us to start publishing posters and advertisements through their portal. And a lot of people with COVID-19 were registering because they wanted to, you know, learn more about this the same way that we did. And then, so I'd say around June is when Facebook got us a lot of people enrolled, and then this Pitt Plus Me system, and it just kind of took off. Our big wave here in Allegheny County really didn't start until July, when the government got more relaxed. And then I think once that happened, we saw a huge surge in cases. And then just recently, I think our most challenging group to recruit for are people who are actually sick with acute symptoms. So fever, cough, shortness of breath. We've had a lot of people who recovered, who are having long-term smell loss, who we've recruited. But to enroll actually people who are experiencing, like, the, I guess I would want to say primary, but the more infectious symptoms of COVID-19, where the virus is replicating in your body. We started recruiting them just the past 2 weeks when infectious diseases partner with us, and we're getting referrals now of newly tested people who are interested in research. And so it's been kind of interesting. Like I said, it ballooned in summer, and now, unfortunately, with cases going up everywhere, we're calling, I'd say, 12 to 15 people almost a day to talk about research.
Wow. That's unfortunate that the cases are picking back up. If people are interested, if they are, let's say, it sounds like the group that you need more people for would be those who are actively experiencing symptoms. If they were interested in getting in touch with you guys for your research study, what would be the best method to do that?
So they could email what's called, it's pretty simple to remember. It's COVID smell study, all one word, at pitt.edu. And they can reach me, and there's a group of med students and undergraduate students who are helping me coordinate this research directly at that email. So they can reach, if anyone's listening and they are interested in the study, if you just lost your smell due to COVID-19, obviously, please feel free to reach out and email us at covidsmellstudy@pitt.edu. Even if you don't want to be in the study and you're looking for advice for smell loss, feel free to reach out, and we're happy to help.
Fantastic.
Yeah. And we also have a website, solvecrs.com, and we have or.solvecrs.org, and there's some information on our research projects there. But yes, happy to provide further information and feedback, and hopefully we can tackle these problems together.
That's a great point. So if there's another route to reach us, if you wanted to email us at info@solvecrs.com, we could also be reached through there to talk about smell loss, or you know, talk about research, even for people who are interested in upcoming studies here at Pittsburgh. If they wanted to reach out, that's also more than welcome to contact us.
Perfect. I'll have to make sure I get those contact details from you guys, and I'll include them in the episode notes for everybody. That way, if anyone is listening and is interested, that they can get in touch with you directly. So sure. Kind of just another thing that's popping up for me is, okay, you have this research study happening, but we are all currently, hopefully, most of us are staying home and in lockdown type of situations. So how are you conducting this type of research with the patients? Is it on Zoom or a phone call?
So everything is done through a secure data entry system called REDCap. And we do everything through email and phone call. So gotcha. Typically, if a patient emails me, whatever they prefer, I can respond via email or call them. And we would send an initial, you know, data privacy protected HIPAA compliant survey where they would tell us about their symptoms, a little bit about themselves. And then after that, we would mail them an upsit, and we'll send them an answer key so they don't have to send anything back to us. They can enter their answers online, and it will actually give them their grade based on their age and gender and upsit score. And then finally, we would send you a series of 7 brain games, which would be it's cognitive testing that covers 14 domains of cognition. And I think it's kind of fun. I mean, it does take about half an hour to do, but it's an interesting way to learn more about how your mind works. So everything, like I said, is remote and done online. Now, for the nose study, we do it in person, but in a research team that we're all sort of working together, we know who we're exposed to. So it's a little bit different.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you. So in regards to another question that I have for you, prior to this study with nose, where you were seeing people, and it sounds like it's in the earlier stages where it's not necessarily like widely available for a lot of people yet. But in your day-to-day work, do you work directly with people who are impacted by smell and taste disorders? Like on a daily basis, do you see patients? I guess this is more of a question for you, Dr. Lee.
Yeah, sure. Yes. So as part of my clinical work, my patient population are mainly people who have lost their sense of smell, either through chronic inflammation or trauma, infection. So smell definitely impacts quality of life in so many ways. And it's important for just the basics of safety, too. If you can't smell fire, or if you can't smell smoke or gas leak, those things can be harmful. So in general, yes, my patients have smell deficits that are really difficult to deal with, but we have multiple modalities. Depends on what causes the smell loss, and we try to really figure out the reason rather than just treating with medications. So our goals are always to try to understand from a symptom perspective what is important to the patient. Because I think in especially in Western medicine, people are, not to speak for everyone, but we often try to just use different medical therapies. But ultimately, sometimes it is more about really listening to the patient and understanding why is it that they're coming to see the physician? What is the symptom that is really impacting their life the most, and then trying to figure out what is causing it and then manage it together. And I think that concept of shared decision making and patient-centered medicine is becoming, thankfully, much more prevalent.
It's actually really nice to hear you say that. As a patient myself and doing these podcast interviews with lots of different people impacted by smell and taste disorders, the number one concern that I hear is that doctors don't listen.
Right.
So it's actually quite nice to hear you say that patient-centered and patient-focused is the way that you function.
Yes, and I think in the U.S., I'm not sure why it is so, but it is more of a, it used to be, I think it's changing, obviously, more paternalistic, but I think it's really important to discuss all the options with patients and then make decisions together. I think in Europe, they have more tools and apps where patients and doctors can communicate effectively and then decide together. Because, you know, a doctor's visit is one point in time. And to get to know somebody and to really understand what they're suffering from, it takes more than just 15 minutes, right?
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, most definitely. So good. It's good to hear that doctors like you are out there and working in the world. So my last question for both of you is, do either of you have anything else that you would like to add or you'd like listeners to know?
I think for me, there's always hope that loss of, I know it can be quite scary and devastating. And thankfully, it seems that in majority of cases, smell does return and we're understanding how smell loss occurs and how perhaps we can do further work for smell regeneration. So I think it's really important to not lose hope that if you do have smell loss, that we are actively working on that, including how to even measure it correctly. Because if you can't measure the degree of smell loss, then can you assess recovery? You know, so we're starting at the very basics, but I think that's why I mentioned paradigm shifting, because I think how we approach these problems, we need to think about smell differently.
Definitely. And John, anything else that you'd like to share?
I guess just off of Dr. Lee's point is, especially for people who are hearing this who have smell loss related to COVID, you know, luckily for those cases, we're seeing a lot of people recover. But I think for people who are having a harder time with recovery, or it's been taking a long time, even years, I mean, there's always people like Dr. Lee, you know, who are working on these issues. Silver lining with 2020 is that, like you mentioned earlier, Katie, is there's so much more visibility now that it's a major quality of life disorder. It affects millions of people. And it does, you know, working with my background in psychology, we try to talk to patients, you know, what is your number one symptom that is harming your quality of life? And I'd say time and time again, we hear a sense of smell. So I think now that there's more visibility, there's a lot more innovation that will be done. I think there'll be calls for grants from the NIH, and there's going to be people, you know, who want therapeutics available for smell loss. And so people are working on these things and thinking about them. And I'd say a very intelligent and creative way and trying to find a solution for a lot of people who are looking for. And so I guess that's about it. If last thing I would say, if a patient is struggling with this, or you're new to smell loss, or if you've been struggling with it for a while, like I said, feel free to reach out to us and we'll do our best to try and provide guidance. And if you have questions about our research, we'll try and keep you updated on progress as well.
Fantastic. Well, I'd just like to say thank you to both of you for coming on and speaking with us today. It's great to hear about your different research studies and about the work that you all are doing. So thank you for joining.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you to both Dr. Lee and Mr. Moore for coming on the podcast and sharing information about their research studies with us. As I said in the interview, it's always great to hear that there are people who are focused on the needs of patients within the medical field. To get connected with them online, please visit the links that I'll post in the episode notes. For this week's episode, I have some additional updates that I'd like to share with you all. I would like to remind everyone that the Smell and Taste Association of North America, or STANA, is being formed. Currently, there are no active patient organizations focused on smell and taste disorders in the United States of America. The aim of STANA is to become this much-needed resource. Stana's mission is to provide a voice for people with smell and taste disorders through education and public awareness. We advocate for funding for research on smell and taste disorders. We collaborate with individuals living with these disorders, healthcare professionals, and institutions to provide evidence-based education, resources, and networking opportunities. We also partner with organizations around the world who are aligned with our vision to broaden our outreach. Stana's website is online at www.thestana.org, and the fundraising website is also available there through GoFundMe. We are raising funds to pay for the startup costs of becoming an established 501c3 organization. If you're able to donate to help us get started, that would be much appreciated, and that's the main thing that we need help with at this time. If you're unable to donate right now, please consider sharing the fundraising page with your networks so that we can raise the funds that we need to get established. For any questions or if you'd like to get involved, please visit the website or email us at info@thestana.org. So my second announcement again for this week is about the former podcast guest, Frauke Galia, who's the founder of Falk Aromatherapy's program. So in September of this year, I participated in her 21-day Jumpstart Smell Training Program, and it was a really awesome experience for me. The program provides daily guidance, a tracking journal, weekly check-ins, and a Facebook support group to help you get connected with others who are participating in the same program. One of my major goals of the podcast has always been to let those of us with smell disorders know that we're not alone, and Frauke's program embodies this sentiment really well. The next program is starting in January, and if you're interested in learning more and signing yourself up, you can visit her website and submit your email address. The program details should be available now, so go ahead and visit the website, which I'll link in the show notes, to get signed up. It was a truly fantastic experience for me, and it helped me stay on track with smell training, and I know that's something that I've really struggled with, so it was great. So please check it out. All right, so back to wrapping up podcast business for the week. If you'd like to get in touch with me, you can email me at thesmellpodcast@gmail.com. You can follow the podcast on social media at The Smell Podcast and visit the website at thesmellpodcast.com. I'm always interested in sharing listener stories. If you listen using iTunes, please rate, review, and subscribe, as that helps the podcast be found by other people. Finally, if you would like to financially support the podcast, you can do so by clicking on the link in the episode description. I appreciate your support, and a big shout out to everyone who currently contributes monthly to the show, because your generosity is what makes the podcast possible. Until next time, have a great day, and if you celebrate Christmas, Merry Christmas to you.